All right, we are back. Hello, Tony.
Hey, Maddie.
It's good to see you again, Tony. I can see you. The audience can't because we are an audio podcast, but I have news about that coming up in just a few minutes, by the way. But first, let's set the table, shall we? Tony does not even know about this.
This sounds like I might have to get some new clothes. I'm not sure.
Quite possibly. Yes, we are P4P. That's Tony Arkin in Brooklyn. I'm Maddie Blake in Rhode Island. We rate and review paranormal-themed film and television. If it's about stuff that we can't explain, Tony and I watch it, we review it, and then we get your thoughts. And it's a lot of fun. We do it because we love it. Tony, tonight, let's set the table. We're going to do Evil Dead Rise. We're going to talk about that film. As I mentioned, I have some news. We're going to start off tonight with your 1930. We're going year by year. 1930 tonight. Tony's going to bring us to school about films in 1930. And also, our top three tonight based on Evil Dead Rise. Tony, what's our top three list tonight to close out this podcast?
Gosh, I'm forgetting what we called it. Top three bad books?
Yeah, bad books.
Okay.
These could, when we get to it, I'll have you interpret how you took bad books. There's a bad book in this movie, but I think bad books could mean a lot of different things.
I'm anxious to see what you've read, actually.
Oh, I don't read.
No?
No. I just see people read in movies and I go, oh, that's what that is.
That looks bad. So any book in a movie is on your list. I love it.
A library, what is it? It's a big building with a lot of books. That's not important right now.
That's where Satan lives. It's horrible.
Well, in this movie, it certainly is. Everything's okay in your life?
Oh, yeah. No complaints. Everything's great.
All right, good. Yeah, same here. Oh, we're as we record this, Thanksgiving is near upon us.
Fast approaching, yes.
Do you have plans? I imagine involve maybe your mother.
Yeah, gonna have Thanksgiving with with my mom, and I don't know. There's sometimes a stray guest who doesn't have a place to go that shows up. I don't know if anybody's gonna, be there in that regard this time. But maybe you're looking at me like you don't have a place to go. Do you need a place?
I'm taking that as a straight up invite.
You got a place at the table. Or you could just send Max down. We could hang out with Max. He probably could use a break.
Oh, yeah, the conversation would be a lot better. Plus, the added bonus, no Sly Stallone movies. Ooh, speaking of which.
I got my hopes up there for a second. Now they're dashed.
Speaking of which, the new Stallone documentary on Netflix. Have you had a chance to check it out?
I have not had a chance yet.
It's really good. He's so perplexing to me. Like, he's such an enigma. I kid a lot. Some of it's tongue-in-cheek. I love a lot of what he's done and loathe a lot of what he's done. He's not like my type of guy either. That's weird. In real life, like, I don't think I would hang with Sly Stallone if he was just like a regular dude. But, he's fascinating to me. The way he talks, he's constantly inspirational, and he's got a high motor, his mind is constantly going. So in the interview, I just thought this part was unique as a filmmaker, Tony, someone who's made a documentary as you have. The guy said to him, the filmmaker's name escapes me. He said, Sly will do these long form interviews and get the most out of you. He said, I couldn't get him to sit. So this documentary has a very interesting look. He's just walking around his house. He's like, when I did this, it's like when you're living life. Life's like a car, it's like a train, and the windows are going by, and you come in here, and you got to make sure that the windows are dead. And he's just like walking around, and the guy's like, I filmed hours of him doing that. And I just thought it makes the documentary really compelling, just as a human being watching his energy. And he's like, hey, I'm in the feel-good business. That's what he says. It's really cool. I think you'd think it was interesting.
All right. Can you get an idea? It's like, does it feel like it was produced by Sly, or is it, like a real honest look?
It doesn't, really reveal any real skeletons. It definitely makes him look accomplished and good. But it also deals with some of the tougher aspects of his life, the loss of his son. I think it's worth a watch, just even as it's got a unique style to it. He's compelling. He's an inspirational character in a lot of ways.
Well, I haven't even seen the Schwarzenegger documentary, so I'm way behind. I may got that one. I got this one.
Is there one?
Yeah, there was
really?
Netflix did a big Schwarzenegger documentary. I haven't seen that one.
Stop being such a pussy.
I gotta go.
I'm way behind. I feel like I've spent my entire adult life with these people in one way or another. Do I have the time to have this all explained to me? I don't know. Maybe I do. I'll see. I'll check it out.
I'm going to make sure you spend a lot more time with Sylvester Stallone.
How much time do they give Nighthawks?
Not enough.
Okay.
Not enough.
Not a fan already. Don't like not the enough. Movie already.
That is a critique I have of it. I would watch an entire documentary about that movie.
I mean, that's what I'm saying. I mean, if come on.
Remember, we were laughing so hard because there's that scene when he's getting the education on the Rutger Hauer character.
When all the policemen are getting debriefed. Yeah. Oh,
and then he's like, he asks one question. I forget what it is. He just asks one innocent question, like, well, are you sure this is the best way to go? He's like, oh, come on, Monero.
Yeah, all this dirty laundry comes up just because he's like, are you sure about this? And they're like, you again with this. Are you sure?
Your wife left you for it. Whoa.
It's a great movie. God.
All right. Well, here's the news I was teasing before we get to 1930. You don't even know about this, but in my day job, or one of my day jobs, I do a local morning radio show. And I was approached by the high school in my town. And they said, we have some students who are interested in doing broadcast for a career, whether it be TV, film, radio. They're just interested in media of all types. And he said, I have one student in particular who is very interested in going behind the scenes in radio and television, maybe news, something like that. And he said, could she job shadow you at your radio show? I said, of course. So we went through the whole rigmarole, the proper channels, all that. And she sat in on my morning radio show with me and my partner, Heather. Her name's Emily. She's fantastic. But there's no way we could have realistically got her the hours that she wanted or that she needed as part of the requirement. She still had like 50 hours. So, and we couldn't have her in there every day. And, you know, and her schedule didn't allow that also. I said, are you interested in like editing? She said, oh, totally. I need to get better at all that. I said, try this. This will eat up some hours. I said, take old episodes of my podcast, Rated P for Paranormal, and I want you to put pictures to the audio and just random pictures, because I have been asked by several of our listeners, would you please put some sort of video component to this podcast on? Because I like to watch my podcast. That's like the new thing. I've always swore this is going to be an audio podcast, but she has gone through a couple of our old episodes, put images, some of which she's created, some of which we created. So I am going to build I'm in the process now, a YouTube channel for Rated P for Paranormal. And there's already, I think, three episodes done. She just completed The Birds, I believe. If you are a fan of this podcast, but you like to watch things on YouTube TV or YouTube, very soon there will be a Rated P for Paranormal option where you can actually watch videos and hear the audio, and then there'll be just images slapped up, some nonsensical, some directly relate to what we're saying, and you'll have that video component too. I'm thinking maybe now that the channel exists, Tony, we do a couple episodes. Maybe one thing we could do is release this video that we're recording here now that you can actually see us.
Well, let me take a quick look around the studio and see if there's anything out and about that shouldn't be here.
Right when you said that, I heard a zipper go down, which is really, I don't think.
Let's see if we're all, can we do this? Yeah, I think we're good. Yeah.
Let me just look around here and see. Oh, no.
Hold on. Now we're good. Okay.
So, so it's an exciting new chapter for Rated P for Paranormal. We'll see where it goes. Right now, it's only a few episodes, but I just heard from so many people saying, like, please put some sort of video component up for the podcast. So this could be the future.
I love it. I think that's great. I'm thrilled that this, Emily, does she really want to do this? Really? If she's willing, I think it's fantastic.
She's very talented, very funny. She gets everything. You know, I'm marveling always at how sophisticated high schoolers are these days. She gets all our references, which is unbelievable. You know, not all of them. I don't think she'll know the 1930 films you're about to go through, but you know what I'm saying. I make jokes, and she knows like the 80s movies and stuff, and it's quite impressive.
Exactly. That's impressive. And so, you know, look, there's room for upward mobility within this franchise. Let's face it. Let's be realistic. I'm excited to have her aboard. I think this could be a great shakeup. I think that it's a wake up call to us to get our act together.
Agreed.
And you know, we should even start thinking about visually what we can include. We could throw her some stuff on our own to put up there. Let's just see how this goes. Let's see if people really want to see our faces. I you know, we'll see about that. But
I might have to bend my arbitrary rule of like, this is an audio medium. It's an audio podcast. Like, people are just not vibing with that. They're like, no, that's true. Maybe old man, well, Blake, but those days are changing.
I don't know when people have time to sit and look at podcasts though. It's like, I can do podcasts when I'm driving or doing errands.
But the people have spoken, Tony. There are vocal critics right now saying you have to put up a video component or you're losing numbers.
Clearly, I don't know anything about the people that listen to the show. It's terrible. I thought I had more of a handle on this pulse, but I don't.
Well, in fairness, I keep them from you.
I figured there was some shenanigan going on.
I've got a whole mailroom here of Hereditary-esque dolls of you sent by listeners that I don't think you want to see.
Well, it would explain some of the bad luck I've been experiencing lately, but okay, this is great. This is fantastic.
Yeah.
I'm gonna surprise you with something then.
Yes.
Okay.
Please.
So as a part of this, it's not a rebranding, but it kind of is. We're not making this a different show. We're adding to the show, right? So let's. We've got a bit of a new segment today. We've got this new thing coming up with YouTube. So I've been thinking about changing our theme song.
Yep.
For a while, we've had the same theme song from the beginning. It's a great song. I love it. I feel now, after hearing some feedback from people, that it doesn't speak of the paranormal to them. Not that it has to be any which way, but maybe it's just time for change.
I think that's exciting. I'm always, like you said, it's if we don't grow and change, then who are we?
My words exactly, although I put it differently.
More eloquent, though, probably.
And we might even be able to include audience people, you know, members as some kind of a test to see what they like and what they don't.
Yes. I love that idea. I really love that idea.
Yeah. If people have, are leaning in one direction, or if they just are like, no, this is the theme song, we can't live without it, maybe we should hear from people on that.
I have all these old notions. Like, I love the iconic songs of my favorite radio shows that started off the radio show. I was a sucker for that. Like, IMS always used the same Rush song, you know. I love that. But this isn't radio. This is a podcast. And so I'm totally open to, like, let's maybe every week we have a different song. I don't care if you're a musician and you're listening to this and you want to submit something, let's go nuts. Let's go crazy.
That'd be interesting too. Or you can have your theme song and I can have mine.
Oh, I like it. We rotate,
or we just record scratch in the middle of one of them and break to the other person's in the beginning of the show.
How about this? We wife swap. I'm just saying, if we're changing everything up.
I love how quickly the math worked there. How quickly you got there from where we were.
Haven't you ever seen the show?
Wow.
It's a reality show. All right. Well, this is all exciting. And to that end, Tony, you mentioned a new segment. I'm very excited about this. I think this puts us in a whole new category of thinking. We're going to go through from 1930. As long as we do this thing, we'll go year by year. And you are going to break down, in your estimation, what, Tony, the top three movies of each year. Is that correct? We're going to do another top three?
In keeping with our three-tiered system, I was just going to pick the three top paranormal,
love it,
or supernatural movies that came out in each year, starting from 1930. There'll probably be some years that are a lot of honorable mentions, because some of them, you know, we started producing a lot of paranormal movies after, you know, the 50s.
So. I love this. I have such a blind spot about old movies like this. So take me to school. Take us to school. Let's go.
And now Tony takes us to the movies. This week, 1930.
The Golden Age, or L'Âge d'Or. This is directed by Louis Buñuel, also written by Buñuel and Salvador Dali. You know, it's really, it's about a man and a woman that are very in love, and they basically go through the entire movie. It's about an hour long, trying to find a place to consummate their relationship, and they are interrupted at every possible turn by their families or the church or some part of, you know, bourgeois middle class society.
Sounds like you just described my high school career. We should probably move on.
It's a little more satirical than paranormal, but it is all dreamy and has very dislogical, surrealistic elements. So I think it counts. Number two is going to have to be a movie that I didn't even know existed. This is a film called Just Imagine.
If the last 50 years made such a change, just imagine the New York of 1980, when everyone has a number instead of a name, and the government tells you whom you should marry. Just imagine 1980.
Directed by David Butler, and it stars, among other people, Maureen O'Sullivan, who later went on to do famous Tarzan movies and other things.
Yeah.
And this is one of the more crazy discoveries I've ever stumbled upon. It, totally new to me. This is a movie made in 1930, about 1980. So it's a fantastical look 50 years into the future from 1930, and they depict 1980 in this movie.
Incredible.
And in 1980, seen from 1930, society is now automated completely with flying cars.
It's always flying cars, isn't it?
Vitamin pills have replaced food, and all people's names are now numbers, and marriages are arranged by the government. And one of the plot points is scientists revive a man who was struck dead by lightning 50 years ago, and they bring him back to life. And it's crazy. It's kind of a romantic comedy about totalitarianism, and it's got a lot of the effects that you saw in like Metropolis.
Yeah.
And it's amazing. I mean, it's incredible what they did with these effects back in 1930. It's great. Also, if you like The Fifth Element, that's this basically where they got half of the ideas.
Great. Incredible to see, I would imagine, a 1930s view of what 1980 New York would look like. And how maybe in some ways they were right on in some ways and wildly off in other ways.
That's exactly right. What they get right is incredible with like video door, you know, doorbells and video conferencing and stuff like that. Flying cars we don't have yet. But, you know, I didn't think we started wishing for flying cars until a little bit later. Metropolis only came out 2 years before this movie. And it's oddly 15 years before George Orwell wrote 1984. And 2 years before Brave New World. So it's
amazing.
A really innovative movie.
Cool. And what's your third, Tony? This is fascinating. Thank you.
Number three has got to be Blood of a Poet.
Blood of a Poet.
This one is another surrealist movie along the lines of The Golden Age, created by another famous surrealist filmmaker, Jean Cocteau, who was also a famous poet and painter.
Wow.
Like one of the big figures of the 20th century, this guy. And this movie is another completely surrealist, sometimes fairly creepy. David Lynch certainly likes this filmmaker, as he does Buñuel. And it's about, you know, an artist whose work comes alive, basically. And a painter, you know, is wiping the smile off a figure that he's drawn on a canvas, and he wipes his mouth and with his hand, and the painting's mouth is on his hand, and then it talks to him, and then he wipes it on a statue, and the statue comes alive. And that's actually, it's brilliantly done with early effects and stuff, but it's really spooky and eerie and very interesting movie. Blood of a Poet, 1930.
Amazing. It's funny how many, and I guess it makes sense when you think about it, how many artists were doing these early films. And I guess when you don't have a long, long history behind you of filmmaking, it would make sense that an actual tactile artist would be the person to step up and say, let me try this with this new film medium. I never thought of it like that.
Yeah, there were a lot. And there continue to be people coming from that discipline, too, including David Lynch, who started out as a painter. But yeah, if you haven't seen any Cocteau movies, he did the original black and white Beauty and the Beast and Orpheus, yeah, which is also part of the same trilogy. It's incredible stuff.
If you had to pick one, I hate to do it to you, but if you had to pick one of these three to go on our shelf, because I can't vote, because I haven't seen any of these, what would you grab?
On a technicality, it would have to be Just Imagine, because it is the purest, most, you know, science fiction-y thing that is here, I think, of the three. It is literally a sci-fi vision of the future, and these others are more poetic, surrealist, not exactly paranormal, so I don't know. I mean, I would say that Blood of a Poet is probably the most impressive all-around accomplishment as a film, but Just Imagine is great.
Tony, thank you. Next week,
1931. Right. I mean, you know, some people might call me and say, I'm off by a year, because sometimes things are released or made at different times and you can't find exactly, but I'm trying to get it as specifically 1930, 1931 as possible.
I love that. This is exciting. And I love to learn about film. I love film. I don't have the vocabulary you have, and this is just thrilling for me. It's like taking a free film class. In fact, another announcement, you're going to have to start paying me to do this podcast. So I'm going to make money and get an education. So
I'm confused at how this works, but I will. I trust you.
Yeah.
Also, YouTube thing. Just for the record, I mean, this one of the reasons I wanted to do the segment was because I want to keep learning about this stuff. Awesome. I mean, I'm learning stuff every time I try to review these. And Just Imagine was brand new. I had no idea this thing existed.
It's inspiring, and it's humbling too, because I see these old films and I'm just always astounded by the level of performance, creativity, the writing, you know.
Yeah.
It's even true of my Oak Island stuff. Like, when I see the things we built with way less equipment, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years ago, the massive works that these men and women were able to build.
I mean, look, the analogy to me is like, you still listen to Beatles records, right? I mean, they had 4 8-tracks, you know. Jimi Hendrix had, what, 8-tracks maximum? Very basic. It wasn't about the technology. And I think, you know, we aren't prejudiced about listening to music from that period. And I find it's odd that people have a resistance. I mean, maybe politically, I can understand some of these films don't represent the viewpoint, but just aesthetically, yeah. I've always been surprised that people don't want to, you know, are kind of averse to black and white or older movies because they think they're old. I mean, I think they're just incredibly new and fresh feeling, but...
No, you're right. I mean, Stallone didn't have a red camera when he made Cobra.
My point exactly.
All right, let's move on to our main feature. Did I forget anything? News, breaking news, announcements, YouTube, 1930. It's time for Evil Dead.
Brothers.
What's up, sis? I had the most beautiful dream. It was the perfect day. And all I could think about was how much I wanted to cut you all open and then climb inside your bodies so that we could stay one happy family.
Tony, Evil Dead Rise is the twisted tale of two sisters whose reunion is cut short, nay, ruined by the rise of a flesh-possessing demon, thrusting them into a primal battle for survival as they face the most nightmarish version of family imaginable. This is written and directed by Lee Cronin, co-produced actually by Bruce Campbell, of course, as we know from Evil Dead, the originals. Tony, Evil Dead Rise, let's get into it. I think I'll start at the beginning. The opening shot is kind of a clever, what turns out to be, spoiler alert, a drone shot. And also, as you learn, maybe more than a drone shot, although it's for us, the audience, in that moment, just a drone shot that you're thinking is something else. And I thought, okay, this is really cool. This is a fun way to start this movie. But then I was also immediately concerned because it became very quickly in those opening moments, like, this kind of obnoxious young man slugging a beer mentions giving his girlfriend Klonopin. And I'm like, okay, this is going to be like a young movie about annoying teenagers that I can't stand in a camp. And there's going to be a lot of campy zombie-like things. And I was quickly, pleasantly surprised that that's kind of not where it went. Not that what I described can't be great. It could have been. But my spidey senses were up. I don't know if they were for you in those early scenes, that very first scene with the kid and saying, I gave her some Klonopin and knock her out. Because I don't think, knowing the Evil Dead franchise, we're going to get any sort of real analysis of like young people and medications today and what they're going through. I'm like, this could be bad.
Well, I think it's really interesting you lead with this, because this to me was literally my only knock on the film. I think that the book ends, and this movie is bookended by a story that doesn't really have anything to do with the main story. It's just kind of like Easter egg little bookends at the beginning and the end.
100% agree.
And I don't, although I find that usually like sound, it feels like a studio, it feels like a money ploy, just like, hey, we got to razz the audience first and get a rise out of them, then start the movie. So if you look at it almost like a short little like cartoon or short film before the film starts, it's a little better, because it's not very Evil Dead. That's at opening, right, and ending. They made a really fatal error for that reason to me, that it's completely not Raimi-esque. I mean, Sam Raimi never gives you characters to hate.
Right.
He never did that.
Right.
Evil Dead has bumbling characters. It has dumb characters. It has like sex crazed young characters, but it doesn't have characters that are made so that you want to see them get murdered. That's not how he rolls.
Right.
And I felt like this was a playbook. This was like the Blumhouse playbook, or like,
that's what it felt like.
Teen slasher playbook of really just kind of tagged on. You're right. These characters aren't people that you like. And it was unfortunate.
Yeah, but I can't be completely mad at it, because it made the switch even more pleasant for me. When we get to the family in question, I was like, ah, right away. When we get there, I'm like, I love this apartment. I love this quirky family. What happened to the dad? I love the mom's like a tattoo artist, and the kids are quirky and weird. The daughter, we meet the young, cute daughter. First time we see her, she's cutting the head off her doll and making a putting it on, attaching it to a stick. What did she call it? Staffany. Cause it's the head is on a staff. She's called it Staffany. And I'm just like,
catch that.
Yeah. I'm just like, I love this. I love this, I was so relieved to get away from what I thought this movie might have been in those opening couple minutes.
I completely agree. Now I've got to say that, okay, I'm going to just come out and say it. I'm in love with this movie. I love this film. I'm a big Evil Dead fan. I'm not like a fanboy over it, in the sense that I don't do collectibles and stuff like that. I mean, I just love those first two films, particularly. Those are the ones. And I thought the last reboot remake, essentially, by Fed Alvarez was well made. I just didn't. It didn't connect with me. It didn't feel like Evil Dead to me. It lacked the humor. It's a well-made horror movie. It's just not my taste. And it wasn't very Evil Dead. This, to me, has Sam Raimi's spirit in it. And this director, writer, this guy, what's his name? Lee Cronin.
Yeah.
He doesn't have a ton of credits. He just, I thought, completely synced up with...
Yes.
With not just what Raimi is about and Evil Dead was about, but where this could go now in the modern kind of movie going world. I just thought it was a knockout.
The only thing I'm aware of Lee Cronin is that movie he did, The Hole in the Ground, because it was right at Sundance a few years ago. And I remember it made a big, he's an Irish guy, I think.
He's from Ireland. He's from Ireland.
And I just remember people talking about that movie. It was one of those buzz movies
Never caught up with that. I don't. Did you see it?
Never did. I never did. And it's a big blind spot. I definitely want to check that out, especially now. Man, I love team and isolation against an unstoppable force movies. Like, be it if they're in a cabin, the woods, a house, a spaceship, or underground or whatever. Like, I love that whole vibe. But it can go really horribly wrong. And we've talked about some on this show. And I think you're right. He absolutely captured into the spirit of Evil Dead in that he's like, no. We're gonna do what this movie does. We're gonna put people in a group, a team, in an enclosed environment. This time it is different, because you're in a high rise in New York City or wherever. LA, I'm sorry, LA. And it's, so it's a little different like that, but no, this has the bones of Evil Dead. It has the spirit of Evil Dead, the humor of Evil Dead and the frights.
Yeah. I mean, think about it. There are no characters you don't like. Like this family, you like everybody. Usually in a movie where there's a team, there's also usually, you know, the guy who plays the asshole who everybody hates, or the guy who's just kind of, or the person who's just kind of awful on purpose so that they can be killed and you don't care. And they don't offer that to you in this movie. They just offer you a bunch of people you hope make it, you know?
Yes, yes.
And that really raised the stakes a lot, and very naturally. And to make it a family, too, we avoided all the tropes of like those teens getting together to drink and have sex and do all the stuff we've seen a bajillion times. Now, this family up against it together was actually made the movie a lot more serious. There wasn't as much kind of humor in it, although there's some.
There's some.
And when it's there, it's the right flavor. But I mean, you know, Ash versus the Evil Dead TV show, for instance, which I really like, is a lot broader and more cartoonish than this.
Very cartoonish. This movie, I mean, it's really about family, and it's about choosing life. You know, like, I want to live. I want to live. And her not knowing what to do. She's in a situation and she doesn't know what to do, where to go. And there's a really compelling scene about her just begging for something in terms of that, you know, and you go, God, this movie has so much heart. And I love that. I love when you get some. I know you hate this. You hate like morality preaching, right? Right. But when the movie has a spirit of goodness, a message of goodness, of like family and love and stick together. My favorite line in the movie is, in fact, is they start to freak out. The mother in the film gets possessed by this demon, which also was a surprise that she got it first to me anyway. And we could talk about that, but she gets possessed, and then things are going crazy and the kids start to fight because one of the characters has brought in a book, which is going to lead to our top three. And it's an evil book that most likely, yes, unleashed this evil into their apartment. So they're about to go at it. She's like, it's your fault. He's like, I didn't mean it. And they're fighting and fighting. And our lead stops them and says, hey, we don't turn on each other ever. And I went, oh, that's what this movie's about. This movie's about family. And so you've got this love, family affirming moment in the midst of abject terror and fun, like demon stuff and all that. I just go, oh my gosh, I love this movie.
I do too. I mean, it's kind of the stand in for the fact that Ash in the Evil Dead, he's kind of a buffoon in some ways, but he's also a true romantic. Like he brings his lady love to the cabin, and they're going to, you know, he's really invested in this relationship. And when it's taken away, like you actually care about this kind of cartoonish world. This movie's a lot less cartoonish, but I think in updating it, they really faced that, and they had to kind of go. And I say this confidently because I've heard interviews with Sam Raimi and Bruce Campbell. Sam Raimi was an executive producer on this, not just, I think, complete hands off direct, you know, producer. I think he was involved in picking the director and okaying the storyline and overseeing it to a degree. And I think they all really felt that, you know, apparently Lee Cronin said, I really want to make this family serious. I want to make this believable. I like these people have to be real people.
Yeah.
And he really kind of leaned into that. And I was surprised that it took it, but ultimately not, you know what? Cause they really got a great cast. These are great. These are wonderful actors for this movie. Lily Sullivan, who plays the younger sister, Beth, I think is just, she goes through such hell.
She's a star.
As a performer in this. And she's so simple and great. And then I got to say, Alyssa Sutherland,
fantastic.
Spoiler alert, just so you know, we have to talk about her work, right? So she's, can we say she becomes a demon? I mean, she becomes possessed.
Yes.
Alyssa Sutherland,
you can see it in the trailer. So
she does, for me, some of the best possesso like acting I've ever seen anybody do.
Dude, it's alternately funny and at the same time as terrifying as anything in The Exorcism of Emily Rose.
Oh yeah,
who she kind of reminded me of.
Well, the body work, the way that she uses her body and contorts, that kind of dance-like weird angular thing is so well done here. But her face, the transformation that happens to her face, which undergoes several different kinds of transformations in a way. They have this look that it's like they her injuries and the blood on her face has made this kind of Harlequin mask, which harkens back to like Jacques Vallée and other things, which I don't know if it was on purpose there, but kind of creepy texture to that. And everything about it was really push-pull. So the comedy was in like how extreme she was as this mom.
Yes.
Saying things like, okay, can I just take a second to say, okay, I have a question for you. Let me put it this way.
Yeah.
When did you know that you were seeing a great Evil Dead movie? What was the moment you were like, okay, we're really here? Because it faltered in the beginning, right?
Yeah. So. Yeah. An early sign, honestly, was the little girl cutting the head off the doll, putting on a stick. But then they like play wrestle her siblings. Take her into the bed in this kind of jump scare moment. You're like, oh, what's going on? And they like play wrestle with her. And the family's kind of falling apart. Father's left. They're hurting. They're getting kicked out of their apartment. But there's this love and warmth there with this mother trying to hold it all together. So I'd say pretty early on, right about the time we meet Stephanie, her head, the stall. But then for sure, 100% for me, the mother's already been possessed. But it's the first really bad incident with that. She's locked outside the door. And the sibling sister says to the sibling, to the brother, you brought the book in this house. It's your fault. And they start to fight. And she says, hey, so it's early on in the attack. And she says, we don't turn on each other ever. And I went, oh my God, that's what families do. That's what successful families do. The demon can be right at the door and you don't turn on each other.
I'll only reflect on that by saying that the demon is mommy. So the family.
Mommy's does gone, turn though. Mommy's right, gone. But
that
mommy's
not, to a, gone. Not to a young person seeing this movie, which is what's so great about it, is true. That it's really terrifying.
And not to the young daughter at first, because she falls for it again. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. For me, I knew I was watching something that Sam Raimi had blessed, right? Just capturing a certain. For whatever reason, it was the scene in the bathtub soon after the mother gets possessed. It's before the door. And. She goes from the bathtub up onto the ceiling.
Yes.
Right. And that's some of the best, like, you know, demon on the wall stuff I've seen. Then the mom has a line and she says, she kind of whispers, mommy's with the maggots now.
Oh, yes.
And I was like, that is.
Yes.
And the glee with which she says it, like how happy she is about it. It was so right on Evil Dead to me. And so like it was. And not only that, was pushing my buttons in the way that the first Evil Dead pushed my buttons when I first saw it. Yes. You know, like I just thought, wow, this is a real Evil Dead movie now. This is really it.
Mom.
Mommy's with the maggots now.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And the way the demons know things about the characters too, and uses it against her sister. The mom demon uses knowledge she has about the sister to really, really get into her psyche. It's more than just a scary zombie movie. It's a psychological thriller too. It's really well done. And the water bubbling in that tub scene was just every little detail of that scene was great. And then and also there's this wonderful humor to it. Like, so as terrifying as that was, and as awesome as that scene is, it's also got that, it doesn't lose that Evil Dead kind of fun to it where they're just watching, like you're watching a TV show and you're as the audience going, get the fuck out of there. But she disappears in the tub and you watch one hand, boom. And then the other hand, boom. Like that's a comedic device. Well, it's scary.
It's scary, but it's also how Raimi has always portrayed these demons in his movies they're always amazing characters. They're never just an effect. They're never just, you know, they all have personality and they have different personalities. And the way that their repartee, that the one-liners they have are really both horrific and really funny.
Yes.
Now folks, this movie is disgusting.
The blood per person in this movie is quotient.
Really disgusting. And yet they're all played like gags still. They're played, you know, there's a lot of punch to this gore and horror, but it's also got enough humor in it for you to be kind of like cheering on the good guys and still invested in it as a ride, you know?
Yeah.
That's a lot to juggle for a new filmmaker with one.
Yes, it is.
Two features, man.
And he was able to like capture elements of like, I saw Signs in this movie, one of my favorites. I saw Poltergeist in this movie, one of my favorites. I saw The Thing in this movie.
The Thing is in it, definitely.
Right? With the final creature and some other moments.
There's The Shining. There's Wolfen. There's Suspiria. There's Demons. There's Rec 29. There's a lot of things that, and they're not just stealing. They're really like paying homage and
yes.
Well, you know, kind of one-upping stuff. It's great.
And so that's the spirit he was able to capture. I think the underlying feel of the movie, the theme of the movie, the love behind it, I guess I would say, is what puts it over the top for me. Because again, I mentioned like a Poltergeist, and we recently reviewed Poltergeist, and there are things that don't hold up. And we were kind of surprised.
We were hard on it, but it's a great movie that we love. Great. Let's
but
face
what it.
It
does, why it works still, is that family and the character, and this movie nails that. It's like, I wanted this family to be okay so bad. Not all of them are. But yet they kind of are, because they fought the good fight. They fought for each other, and people do die and things do happen. And evil is out there at our apartment doors trying to do terrible things to our family, but they never turn on each other, and they fight and fight and fight to the end. And I think it's kind of a beautiful movie that features people getting puked on with gallons of blood, which is awesome.
It's the most beautiful movie that involves people getting puked on with gallons of
probably
blood.
Probably.
I'll
top
say
three.
That.
Oh, yeah, man. What a pleasant surprise. I'll tell you again, I want to go back to that opening scene, because again, I thought it was going to be a Blumhouse cabin in the woods, demons in the woods, and these annoying teens having sex and the same old thing. And I was just like, wow, when we get to that family, that little apartment, I'm like, I don't ever want to leave this apartment. And guess what? We don't really.
No, you don't really. You stay there. And it's a great, like, you know, pressure cooker environment for this to happen. And honestly, beautifully shot. The effects are great. I mean, they're really, really effective. I thought the creature effects and the violence is, you know, you feel it. It's not, I don't know. It doesn't seem to be designed to really, really scar you. It seems to be designed to, like, you know, give you thrills and scare you, but it doesn't feel mean spirited, which is funny because it's some of the worst things you've ever seen. I mean, like a mother turning against her children this way is horrific. I mean, it's truly, like, conceptually one of the places you just don't really see people go to a lot in movies that, you know, it's really dark.
It was so very surprising that she got it first. And
this is like what the movie is. They're just getting attacked viciously by their mom. And it's terrifying.
Here's a funny coincidence. So I was writing in my notes. I was looking at, as you were talking, I was going like, oh no, oh no. And I mentioned the Klonopin reference. I go, this is going to be a movie about young people. They're going to do some half-hearted. Now this is just me spouting out what I thought it was going to be at that point. It's going to be some half-hearted messaging about how young kids today are a mess, walking around like zombies on these prescription meds or something like that. And then I said, wait a second, this might be about mothers and what they're going through in today's society, and kind of Babadook-ish. And I'm telling you, it did a way better job of that than what I thought it was going to be with the teens.
And, I agree.
I do think there was a lot there, because her sister's also, spoiler alert, fast forward if you don't want to hear it. There's your chance. The sister is pregnant, and she's struggling with that. So you have two female leads coming together, estranged. One is pregnant and doesn't know what to do. The other is a single mom. And there's this demonic force at their door, crushing in on them, oppressing them. And I'm like, okay, man, this movie has a little bit of meat to the bones, right? But not obnoxious, not preachy. They react with support and fighting for each other. And I just, there's very little cynicism, again, in a movie where there's like a lot of blood and demons, which is awesome.
I have like a phrase that I came up for, you know, Evil Dead's vibe, Sam Raimi's vibe, which is like warm nihilism.
Yes, that's so good.
It's like,
that's
warm,
so good.
It's a warm nihilistic hug. I don't know how else to put it. It's weird.
So good. Yeah, like how can I be watching this much gore and horror and feel such connection and love and call it a family movie.
I think part of it, and I got to say, you know, I got to say a lot of this thrives on just the passion of filmmaking too. Mm. A lot of the warmth I get out of this movie, and I certainly got out of the first two Evil Dead movies, is just the love of filmmaking, of making a ride for people, of having this, you know, this blessing to be able to make stuff for people like that.
Mm. Yeah.
They so seem to thoroughly enjoy it that there's such love and enthusiasm in the making of these films. I find that infectious, and there's something just warm about that too. It doesn't feel like, you know, some horror movies kind of take on like a faux brooding self-importance that I just find to be kind of stupid, unless they're really smart. Then they're usually not that smart.
Right.
This one just rides on just unbelievably enthusiastic filmmaking and action stuff that isn't hackneyed. It's really like you see filmmakers like really like challenging themselves to make every single shot in these sequences like sell something and be really far, you know, really not just slick, but full of an enthusiasm and excitement. I just think it's great. I'm a weirdo because literally this could be top three for us down the road. Like, there, weird things make me cry. That's true. Like I cried watching Evil Dead once, like the first one.
I believe it.
And I literally was like, the thing that made me kind of tear up was this enthusiasm, this passion for making this art. It's just infectious, you know? So there's just something so profound about that. And this franchise, because of Sam Raimi's friendship with Bruce Campbell also, and that long friendship and this project that's gone on for decades now, there's a lot of family love around it somehow, you know?
Fantastic. Well, give me that again. Comforting nihilism. What did you call it?
Warm nihilism.
Warm nihilism. I think that needs to be the name of a book, and you need to look at you need to break down examples of this.
This is one of the only examples.
Yeah. There's a few, but not many. I'm trying to think of the movie. We reviewed a movie like this. You know what it was? I got it. You're going to be proud of me. It was The Gate.
Oh, absolutely.
This movie has a little gate to it, doesn't it?
Yes, especially, I totally agree.
And I'll give you an example. The heart, the love, the family, the warmth, all that amidst horror. But also even like when the parents are going like, you are one of us. And at the end in this movie, they're chanting, everyone will die at dawn. I'm like, this is like
dead by dawn, dead by. Yeah. They bring that back. It's great. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It is. You're right. That's a great call, Maddie. That's great. That's very true. I'll say, I think even Halloween is similar and warmly nihilistic, you know,
100%.
Yeah, it's a sweet spot, and I really do appreciate it when movies can kind of capture that. Do you have favorite moments, lines of dialogue, shots, anything
specific? I wish I had written it down. Another great use of the C word. I'm going to go to confession, but that's my shotgun, you or something like that.
Yeah, they get spicy with the language.
That's when I think of the filmmakers. Like, and I just have such joy of thinking of them just dying laughing, like, all right, let's get this shot. Come on.
Can we get away with this?
Like, the line again. Yeah.
You know, they shot an alternate where she said something else.
Yes, yes. Like, he called her a bitch or something. Yeah, fantastic. Again, the We Don't Turn Each Other might be, if we do a Tony and Maddie Awards this January, that might be my line of the year, my scene of the year. I just really adored that. And then the final favorite, I think, is the shots of the mother through the peephole.
Oh, great.
Which to me
the
were
the peephole sequence is great.
That's what I mean. And they kept going to it, but it kept working. And they didn't rely on, I kept waiting for like every time they show the peephole, the mother's going to just bound up and it's going to be a jump scare. There's a couple jump scares in those moments, but that's not why it's there. It's eerie. There's things that happen outside the purview, the view of the peephole that are creepy. You don't know what's going on. Really well done. And her eyes in those scenes, man, it's as good as it gets.
Open up now.
You don't look so good, Mom.
Nothing.
big old kiss from you won't fix.
It's not a movie that relies on jump scares. None of these movies have been. That's the kind of mastery of it. He doesn't really need them because he's dealing with stuff like where the terror is increasing during the sequences that you're seeing. It's just not a style of horror movie we've seen in a while, in my opinion.
In fact, to highlight your point, not only are there not many jump scares, actually he slows down. One example I think of to great effect is when the daughter, Bridget, becomes
played by Gabrielle Eccles, who's wonderful.
So good. She clearly has got the bug. Our lead walks into the kitchen and she's got her back to her and she's doing something horrific, but there's no blah, which I was kind of waiting for. She slowly turns and we watch it happen slowly and deliver the dialogue. Oh, and there's a couple instances of that in this movie where he actually slows down and it makes it worse. The tub scene, for example, that's dragged out and they sit there and watch in terror. She disappears and you have to watch with them and you're going, climb out of the bathroom, get out of there.
Yeah. Dread is just the best, you know. Yeah. It's underused, but it's good underused. When somebody nails it. I have to say that for me, there's one line in this movie that killed me. Loved it. It's when the mom, and she's already turned and she breaks back into the apartment and they're all kind of standing there shocked. They don't know what to do. And she says, "Eeny, meeny, miney." And it's the way she delivers that line. Yes. She doesn't even get to mow. It's just great.
That's awesome.
And then I also love the fingernail on the record album.
Oh, and then the speakers come out of her mouth.
The demon, like, brilliant. They're playing a record and she puts her fingernail on it instead of a record needle. And then the voice from the record, it's fantastic.
Brilliant device. And then the fact that Stephanie, the doll, comes into play.
Brilliant.
In a big way.
You know it's coming.
You know it's coming somewhere. Setup,
but they do it. They constantly, I don't know, they really up it. They push the limits. And they're like, when that doll comes back into play, you're not sitting there going, oh, I knew that was going to happen. You're sitting there going, oh, my God. Yeah. I can't believe they had the guts to actually put that on film. I can't believe they did that.
So good. Final thoughts here as we...
Just that for a movie with this much vomiting in it, I can't believe you're on board.
Surprised. I know. That's how good it is. That's how good it is. Yeah. It broke my own rule about vomiting.
Yeah. Headline: Don't even mind the vomit, says Maddie.
I'm going to go on a Maddie rant here. But see, there's a point to the vomiting in this movie because most vomit scenes, like, we get it. She's sick. He's sick. We don't need then the 5 minutes of retching on the toilet. Like, we get it. This was like revealing things. Like, what they were throwing up was kind of important in a way.
So your problem has to do with the lack of specificity, not the vomiting. It's interesting.
I'll sit through anything if there's a point. Kind of like this podcast.
Well, I don't know what... We'll find the point. Let's find it.
All right. Well, let's get to the point. Oh, the point is this. We're giving this a P for Paranormal going on the shelf, correct?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, hands down.
Now the whole franchise can get up there as far as I'm concerned. The whole Evil Dead idea is up there.
Yeah. I'm down. Great job, everybody involved. Great job.
That's not good.
Thusly inspired by Evil Dead Rise, which features a flesh-hewn book of evil spells and demonic activity, Tony and I thought it'd be a great idea to look back on the top three for each of us, top three bad books in paranormal film history. Tony, why don't we just dive right into it? We call it the bad book. The spirit of this movie is that it's an evil book or like some sort of spell or witchcraft or demonic book. But I kind of widened it a little bit to maybe it's just a bad book that the people involved with it or who come near it might have been better off, would have been better off had the book not been present. So it's a little bit of a wider berth. So my number three is a movie that's fresh on my mind because I saw it just around Halloween time. And the book itself is not bad necessarily, but the person and the circumstances by which she receives it, all hell breaks loose. And that's a movie called Saint Maud. And in the movie, the character Maud, who's a caretaker for a woman, is given by the woman a book of the works of William Blake, religious imagery. And at that point, when she gets that book and the way it's signed to her, she kind of it begins her degeneration in so many ways. It begins her descent into fervent madness.
I'm remembering that now. That's great.
Yeah. Yeah. The images in that book really trigger her. She signs the book to Maud, to my savior. The person who gives that to it doesn't mean that literally. She takes it literally. So that book creates all kinds of hell
for
both characters. So the book from William Blake, of William Blake's artwork in the movie Saint Maud, is my number three.
Great call.
Thanks, buddy. You're number three.
My number three is it's To Serve Man from The Twilight Zone, season 3.
Whoa. Great pull, Tony.
Thank you. I was pleased with that arriving, because I had not planned for that, but it just kind of popped into my head. And I don't even want to give it away if you haven't seen it, because it's one of the great Twilight Zone episodes of all time. It's called To Serve Man, and it involves a book. And it's maybe one of the more famous episodes of Twilight Zone.
Yes, so
you
definitely
probably have seen it, but I don't know. I don't want to give it away, but I think that's got to be my top three.
That is so good. How did you think of that one? I haven't even thought of that one.
I don't know. I think that title was the title book. Of that book is so, it's just such a classic thing. I it just kind of popped into my head, and I didn't even remember at first where it came from. At first I thought it was like from Soylent Green or something. And that's the catchphrase, and it's similar. God. So
Those aliens are the spookiest.
That's ever, so good.
Ever.
Great.
Okay. Number two is again, another movie that I recently saw right around Thanksgiving, Halloween. I watch bloody horror movies during Thanksgiving. No, it's called A Dark Song, and it's a ritual movie. Have you seen A Dark Song, Tony?
I think I may have, but I'm blanking. You got to refresh my memory. Yeah,
it's about a woman who hires a guy to perform a ritual.
Yeah, yeah, it's really good.
It is
low budget, like just two people, right? Yeah,
two really people good. In a house. And the spooky thing is they use a book. It was an actual like ritual book used by Crowley in his manifesting of things he shouldn't have been manifesting, depending on your where you come from. And so that freaked me out, because they use actual parts of actual spells in that movie. And it's an actual like spell book to manifest stuff.
I'm not surprised.
That scared the crap out of me. And it's a book I will never open. It's a bad book, everyone. It's a bad book.
I have to also just give a shout out to Steve Oram, who plays the guy she calls in for help. Fantastic actor from UK. He's been in a lot of wonderful things, including, I think, did some Ben Wheatley stuff. He's in Sightseers, which is a really good comedy by Ben Wheatley. He's in a couple of things. Really a terrific actor.
Like an hour and 45 minutes of slow torture, and then it takes a twist that is very surprising and very sweet. This could be a candidate too for a movie that has, as dark and horrific as it is, has a spirit of heart and forgiveness and love to it, actually, in a weird sort of way. So
I just remember the scary parts, but maybe there is love there. I don't know. I got to see it again. I love that movie, though.
There is. The whole movie, you could make an argument, is about forgiveness.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Whatever. Let's keep going. my number two.
Yes.
My number two, I got to give it to All Them Witches from Rosemary's Baby.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great call.
I mean, it's just kind of in the background. It's not even a big thing in the movie, but every time it's brought up, it just doesn't feel okay at all. And it's referenced a few times. And there's been a lot of, I think, films and maybe even books that now kind of reference that title and call itself All Them Witches. But I think that's where it comes from initially. Yes. Unless this is a real witch anthology book that you might know about.
It could be.
I certainly should have looked that up, but I just know that has always stuck to my mind as one of the creepier books and movies. That's a bad book.
That is a bad book, brother. Now, my number one
is going to be stretching the boundaries, but I couldn't think of a worse book for a human being. And although not strictly from a paranormal movie, the movie franchise of John Wick does include a secret society, if you will, which is, it does fit under our purview. And in the movie John Wick, John goes to the library and takes out a book that is hiding items he needs, and including pictures of his wife, money, I believe, IDs, things like that. One of the great fights in cinematic history then happens when another killer comes to kill him, and John Wick uses this book to absolutely pummel this human being in a way that you would never think a book could be used in this violent of a manner, culminating with him breaking the guy's neck over the spine of the book. And the beautiful part is, during their fight, which is one of the most underrated moments in film history, as they're having this brutal, unbelievably awesome in close fight, the killer trying to kill him actually goes, shh, because they're in the library right before John Wick breaks his neck with the book. So it was my number one, because I just could not think of a worse book for anybody than have your arms, shoulder, and then finally your neck broken by a book.
That's a tough read.
I've read books that felt like that.
That's a tough read.
You sure this is what you want to do?
40 million, it's a lot of money.
Not if you can't spend it.
Excellent. Okay. Well, I'm confident that my top number one kicks all the books off the shelf.
Can I guess? Think.
You probably know what it is.
Does it have only one line in it over and over again?
Yes, it's the same line over and over again. I think that Jack Torrance's unpublished novel is the scariest book that has ever been in a movie.
Amen. I only didn't pick it because I knew you were going to, and I needed it to be you.
How do you like it?
I have a few like honorable mentions, because it was tough, because it's like I kind of want to avoid picking these big heavy hitters all the time. But this is just a case where I've just never, that book scares the hell out of me. Every time I see that movie, it's just terrifying. It's what it represents, the book itself, the whole thing. It's horrible.
It's probably like top five ever reveals in film history.
Ever.
That's what he was writing.
It's one of the worst things in that moment. It's the worst thing you've ever seen in your life.
And all the different, they're not fonts because it's type of, the different, like, he's doing capitals,
lowercase, his mistakes and certain, it's just incredible.
And then like different, some of them are like funneling down into like a centered, like it's just.
Yeah. And every page was hand typed by Stanley Kubrick's assistant. Who did it for months, who just wrote that for months, who was typing that line over and over again. I think she did like three pages a day for months.
This is one of our best top threes. I think these books are all bad. Well done. The honorable mentions you mentioned, I had, of course, Jack's book, because I knew you're going to pick it. I also have mentioned Hereditary way too much in this show, so I didn't put it in my top three, but it could be number one. The Invocations book in Hereditary that she goes to is terrifying.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it is. Conceptually, it certainly is. But I went, okay, so I would go with, I guess, the one that I didn't know whether it should belong on the main list or not is The Babadook, because I think the book in that is great, and the artwork in it is perfect. And that's another scary book. The book itself is scary.
Yes, and it's so central to the whole plot.
Yeah.
It's like the first time we get introduced to the character.
Yeah. And if that artwork hadn't been good on that book, if you didn't buy it as a real children's book, it never would have worked. And they totally sold that.
Yes, yes.
You have any other honorables? Stuff you don't read a lot, so we'll just like make this quick. I'm going to have to say that another honorable mention it was a tough decision, was The Ninth Gate. Johnny Depp plays an investigator who looks for rare antique books, and he gets hired by the wrong person to find a book that he really doesn't want to find. It's the, you know, Satan's, you know, address book or whatever. I don't remember what it is, but that's a good one.
Is D Dear Diary.
And then two others, they're kind of minor in a way, but they're also kind of great, like Mickey Mouse's Magic Book and the Sorcerer's Apprentice.
Yeah, that starts the classic whole fever dream acid trip. Yeah.
Yeah. And then the book in Jaws where Brody's wife is flipping through the shark book.
What a pull. And sees the
shark attacking the boat, and then she screams for her kids to get out of the water. That's a great book.
Wow, what a pull, Tony. Awesome. You know, this is one of those categories again where I saw in my mind like a bunch of people getting hit and slapped by books, but I couldn't recall. Right, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and also I know I'm forgetting a few that are great. Like there's one that hinges on an address book or a small like notebook that somebody's got to find. I think there's a Hitchcock movie I'm forgetting.
Okay, yeah. There's the Book of Eli with Denzel Washington. He's blind and protected.
But as far as paranormal stuff, this is like this is what my research got me anyway. I don't know.
If we went plural, Ghostbusters, the library scene, those books come flying out. Those are bad books. You won't get hit by one of those.
Don't. No, you know, honorable mention for sure.
Well, Tony, this has been great fun. Next week, we will talk about the paranormal themed film, No One Will Save You. This was released this past year in September on Hulu. No One Will Save You, about a girl who must battle, let's just say, something from above that's been in the news a lot lately. We will discuss. Don't read any bad books until we meet again, okay?
Don't read at all. Don't do any of that, Maddie. I don't want you to hurt yourself.
This is a message I approve.
We hope you've enjoyed this edition of Rated P for Paranormal. Please rate, review, and share. It really does make a difference. On social media, we're at Rated Paranormal. All music is by Andrew Galvins Jr. You can find him on Instagram at Kid Riga or go to therocketscience.bandcamp.com. This podcast was created, written, produced, and edited by Maddie Blake and Anthony Arkin.
Is about forgiveness.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Whatever. Yeah.